This is Red Ice Radio, a beacon of sanity from Northern Europe. RedIceCreations.com.
Welcome back, boys and girls. Thank you for tuning in to Red Ice Radio. It's always great to be able to speak to you. My name is Henrik, and our website is RedIceCreations.com, where you can follow us on a regular basis. Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, newsletter, and RSS feeds are some of the other channels, if you will, where you can find us and follow us as well. We have political writer Diana Johnstone with us from France. She is the author of Fool's Crusade, Yugoslavia, NATO, and Western Delusions. She was with us about a year ago when we talked about NATO and the invasion of Libya. And as we've now seen, that went just great now, didn't it? Turned out excellent for the psychopathic, satanic murderers who seek to create chaos, destruction, and mayhem in their tracks. Great work, guys. Job well done. Today we're going to shift focus and talk about Mohamed Merah, who shot 7 people dead in France in March this year, 2012. And Johnstone's article about this called The Toulouse Murders. We are also going to discuss the French election. Sarkozy is gone, and in comes now Francois Hollande. Who is this guy, and what is the difference, if any? We tie in the shaky and unstable situation in the European Union as well. How will the future of this crooked institution look? Stay with us for more. Welcome back to Red Ice Radio, Diana Johnstone. It's great to have you with us again. Thank you for coming on the program.
Well, it's a great pleasure to speak with you.
Excellent. Good to have you back. And of course, today we are going to talk about the situation in France. What is going on in France, and specifically with the latest thing of the election, of course. But all of this thing has, interestingly enough, been wrapped around something that you've been writing about called the Toulouse murders. And an excellent article that you posted here or released couple of weeks ago now, over a month ago, obviously now, and about the situation. And I think we should begin here for people who might not have followed the story or paid that much attention to it. So wherever you'd like to begin to kind of set the groundwork here would be great, Diana.
Well, I think you're referring to the incident at the beginning of April, which came at the start of the presidential election campaign, when an individual shot several people, two soldiers and 3 people at a Jewish school, including 2 children, or was it 4 people, 3 children and a teacher. And the whole story was that he was cornered by the police, and it was said to have said he was doing this in a sort of Al-Qaeda way of revenge for foreign wars and for wars against Muslims and so on. And then he was killed by the police, and the whole thing seemed at the moment to be something that was going to mess up the presidential election campaign, since it came just at the beginning of the presidential election campaign. But in fact, it had no impact whatsoever.
That's right. Very interesting. You speculate a little bit in the article that you wrote about this, that it could potentially have been something to do with Sarkozy and the fact that he wanted to steer the election his way. And after the incident, after Mira, as it's known as, after he was shot and killed after this incident, there was a tremendous rally, at least in the media. you got this impression anyway, that people were rallying behind Sarkozy, and his support went up tremendously in France. Do you know if that's true?
Well, I don't think that's true at all. Who said that?
Exactly, the media, mostly,
his support,
what I heard.
Polls showed that his support did not go up at all. It had no effect. What happened is simply that because he was the president and the other candidates are not the president, he had the chance to play the role of president and keep reassuring the public and coming on stage a lot. There was a ceremony of for the victims. Well, the Jewish victims. I think the ceremony was in Israel, so he wasn't there. But the military victims. There was a military ceremony. Other candidates went, but they just had to stand there. And Sarkozy, of course, this was a chance for him to get in the limelight. Now, I have never suggested, and I'm not the person to suggest, that this was something that was arranged by the government, blah, 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 you know, mm-hmm. for,
right.
I don't believe in that kind of conspiracy. I don't know exactly what happened, and I think it was very, shall we say, unfortunate, or that the... well, you have to call him a suspect at that point because there was no trial.
Well, exactly.
Was killed by the police instead of captured, and it seems strange that all those police couldn't capture this man, even if he was armed. But anyway, they didn't, and of course that in itself is going to feed suspicions. Except that even the suspicions have gone away. The fact is that the incident has been forgotten with astonishing speed. When you think all of the fuss that is made about terrorism, or even non. I mean, here you did have six or seven, because there was somebody else who was seriously wounded, I don't know, victims actually, you know, shot dead. And you've had much more fuss in the United States because somebody supposedly might have had something explosive in his shoe. I mean, it just shows to me that the French are a little bit more level-headed than the Americans.
Well, the strange thing here that you mentioned then is, of course, after 30 hours of a siege here with the Mera, he got a bullet through his head. That's what we know. There had been no trial and no questioning, as you say. But there's a strange thing I want to ask a little bit about his traveling. Reportedly, he's been to Lebanon, Turkey, Syria, Tajikistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and even Israel. So who is this Mera? What do we know?
Well, we don't know very much about him. Well, I mean, maybe there isn't that much to know. It does. I mean, I can only have hypotheses, which are not really just mine, because there's been other speculation. But it does seem that he had some contact with the police. Now, this could very well be that he was a young man who was kind of unsettled, you might say. And had gotten into trouble quite a bit before he was of an age to be sent to prison. Mm. So he had a record before he even grew up. I mean, you know, thefts and things like that. And so he would have had a reason to make a deal with the police. And so it's possible that, it seems even probable that the police had were trying to use him for as an informer about things. And that could explain, I mean, accepting the version that of his motives, that could explain why they decided to kill him, because in a trial it would have been very embarrassing to the fact that the police didn't arrest him sooner.
Because they knew about him. Exactly.
He was very well known to the police, and after the first two killings, in fact, after the first one, no, it was seven. Yeah, because it was there was one person who was killed, and then afterwards it was a second attack, and there were clues from that first one, as it turns out, that the police were very slow in catching this guy, that could be very embarrassing, and I think. There could have, although the government at first said they absolutely wanted to capture him alive, and that seems a reasonable thing to do, that as the hours went on and more information became available to the authorities themselves at the top, they could have thought, wow, you know, a trial with this guy, for one thing, he'll get to rave about his ideas, which we don't want to hear, and also embarrass the police, so maybe it is better that he's finished off.
Absolutely.
I tend to think that that's what happened.
Okay, yeah. So do you think they intentionally maybe let down their guard? As we know, a certain amount of domestic terrorism is in certain instances something that can benefit the powers that'd be inside of a country. They use this to their own advantage, of course, to advance
their
own
agenda.
I
don't think they're that calculating. I think the thing is that Sarkozy's whole policy on this kind of thing was totally contradictory, in the sense that he was always raving about security. But the fact is that his main issue was not security. That was for the public speeches. His main issue was cutting government expenses. He is in there. He was in there as the candidate of the neoliberals to cut back government expenses, and that meant cutting back every kind of public employee, including the police.
Mm-hmm.
And the police, while he was talking about all the security, they were cutting back the police forces. There was a demonstration in Paris yesterday about the police. They're very unhappy because they have too much work and too few people working for them. And so, you know, I think people tend, oddly enough, to often underestimate the main factor of human life, which is incompetence. And when you also have a fluctuating kind of leadership and cutting back and firing people or not replacing those who retire, your incompetence is likely to increase, and I think it has.
Yeah. Well, and that's okay, absolutely. I guess I'm inherently more suspicious than that, because I do see that a situation like this with Mera, if they indeed let their guard down in a way, this is something that would benefit them then at the end, because this would show to the public that, look, we need more police, we need more security out there, right?
Well, actually, they do. I mean, the way the police have been operating is to have nobody around who knows a neighborhood or who knows anything, and then they send in these kind of squads like the COS, like a foreign invasion when something goes wrong, which
mm-hmm.
just irritates everybody. It's a very bad way to run a police department. Or police department, it isn't that. It's the national police in France. It's a particular thing. But they've been very badly directed for the last years. They've been trying to get brownie points for questioning people and stuff like that, and not, you know, just not well operating very well. But if this had been something that was set up, then I think you'd have seen more effort to exploit it, and that didn't happen. Everybody was saying, all of the media, including the candidates, and everybody was saying, well, Mera is not typical of our peaceful Muslim community,
mm-hmm.
et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
There was a huge damage control effort on the part of everybody, even the most extreme right, supposedly, although she's hardly more extreme than Sarkozy in this field. Marine Le Pen was saying, well, you know, he's not, because she too has voters that are Muslim.
So they're all thinking about that. They're all having that in mind and thinking, okay, we need to deflate the situation if there's anything, you know, potentially closing to the fact that people are going to be just upset with every Muslim out there and on the streets, basically.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Well, for one thing, the public didn't get excited about it, but also there was nobody trying to make them very excited about it except the usual suspects, which are a couple of people around Sarkozy who were grumbling about, but they have lost all credit.
You've been following, Diana, if you will, you know, Bernard Henri Levy. How did he how did he react in this situation? Do you remember?
Oh, well, he reacted as usual. It's he just thought of the Jewish victims. You know, here it can happen in France that Jews are... I mean, he just carries on his usual line that that France is anti-Semitic this is total fiction. His own career sort of shows that Jews can really succeed in France beyond their capacities. But he does it. Unfortunately, I think he has some influence in the United States because he gets published there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. So standard protocol from him, and so this is the usual anti-Semitism, and Who were the paratroopers, and what was the reasoning for this? Were they fighting
in Afghanistan?
Okay.
It was about Afghanistan. It was at first it was said because they were of Muslim origin, maybe, or something like that. I don't know that it was had to do with that. It didn't have to do with that. It had to do he was taking revenge for the war against Muslims in Afghanistan.
Because first people thought that this was another Breivik, but down in France, the Norwegian.
Well, everybody's looking for that.
Yes, yes.
I mean, I think people are absolutely jealous of Norway, right? For having such a notorious Nazi, or whatever you want to call it, you know, racist, because they're all looking for that. No, I'm joking, graveyard type humor. I mean that just shows that the dominant ideology here is anti-fascism, not racism.
So if we move on a little bit here, then I mean it's a tragedy always when human life is thrown down here onto the line for something that we at this stage don't even understand why. We don't know if this is just the lone gunman again acting out of his own willpower, or if there's something else going on there. And I think it's important that we ask these questions and have the freedom to be able to ask them. Is someone else involved? Was he manipulated, etc.? Is there anything on that note that you think is worth mentioning? Any other more question marks around this event?
Well, I think that there's a general feeling from people who study this more than I have. There's all this huge anti-terrorism stuff. I mean, I don't even want to fly anymore because it's so harassing to get on a plane.
It is. Yes.
Well, I mean, not here so much, but I wouldn't go to the United States. But
I feel harassed in every country, Diana, but go ahead.
What?
I feel harassed in every country I've been to.
Yes, that's true.
Germany,
but I think
France,
the United
Holland,
States takes
US,
the lead, and then the others all
Sweden.
Follow.
Yep, yep.
That's the problem. They all follow. When the United States does it, everybody does it. But but not only that, there's all these anti-missiles and blah, blah, and all this stuff. But somebody can just take a little gun and go shoot somebody. I mean, you just can't have absolute security. That's clear. And one person can do that. It's not... It's not so incredibly complicated.
That's a very important point. Let's just discuss that a little bit more. You cannot have absolute security. What is going on with society where we expect that everything should be 100% secure all the time? And this is, of course, being exploited as well, both by the political powers and the media as well, that as soon as something like this happens, the focus... And the intense analysis of such a thing, I think it should be there to a certain extent, but it put demands on both police and everybody else that is beyond. Because as we know, Diana, if we would have a strict and secure society, there wouldn't be much freedom at all. And we're closely moving in that direction.
I think we're moving in the direction of no freedom, but not any more security, because. All of this, you see, I think the real security is to have a society where people are more or less calm and can get along with each other. And all of this excitement about this and that terrorism, and we have to go have some war against this people and a war against the others and so on, that is what is creating... this sort of thing. I mean, we've been making war in Afghanistan for more than 10 years, killing innocent civilians constantly, drones and mistakes and people going in and wiping out a family in the middle of the night, that sort of thing, and well, that's just a little mistake. Well, you know, I don't think it's so extraordinary that somebody who identifies with the victims of this could get excited and decide to do something in revenge. I think that's to be expected. I think it happens very rarely considering the provocation. I mean, the United States is killing people and killing families, killing children, and you expect nobody to resent that?
Yeah. If there was, and this has been argued by others, if there wasn't any genuine, I mean, there's always been a level of terrorism, but maybe not to the extent that we've been told it is. But at this stage, Diana, where we have so many countries, the U.S. included, but also everybody else that are involved in this, even Sweden included in that, have now gone into many of these countries and destabilized them. They've created civil war in that case. This has created more terrorism than ever before in history, I think.
Well, yes, and you know, somebody who's really very, very conservative, in fact, way to the right of me, Ron Paul, says exactly this. And that's just common sense. Excuse me. It's just common sense that if you're constantly going and making war against people, they're going to get annoyed.
Of course. Well, of course. It's a no-brainer. And the question is, again, then, is that the point? I mean, we have strategies in the books here, the ideas like the clash of civilizations, strategy of tension. We had the Gladio network, domestic terror. Is this the future we're looking at of internal small little terror wars going on in every single country in the Western world or what?
Well, I think we come back to the good old military-industrial complex in the United States. You know, the whole U.S. economy, which is pretty badly off, you know, their only really important manufacturing sector is weapons. And the whole Congress depends on having defense, as they call it, which is, of course, offense or aggression contracts in their districts to manufacture this or that. And also the home security industry is also something. All of these devices to survey the population and torture machines. All of that is business. It's business. It's the only kind of manufacturing that the United States is selling at right now. And then they can hope to sell it to other countries too if they can scare the others. So fear is good for business.
Yes, well, good point, exactly, and that's very unfortunate. I think it's, in the short term for them, it might be good for their business, but as we know in the long term, this is very detrimental to all life everywhere. But Sarkozy is gone now then. This situation with Amera in Toulouse didn't help him at all, if that's what was the intention of this, if it was a plot, a conspiracy in any regard, or if they even sought to take advantage of the situation. It didn't help. Tell us a bit about what happened during the election, and I want to hear a little bit about the new guy that's in office now.
Well, you know, so far he's not very interesting. He got the nomination, of course, after that rather horrifying JFK scandal, which I can just not talk about because it just goes on and on. Mm-hmm. I mean, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, that sort of goes on and on, but. Fortunately, that came out before the election campaign because that would have been a disaster that could have reelected Sarkozy if that had not come out when it did. So Hollande just was, you know, as he said, he's the normal guy because Sarkozy is seen as kind of abnormal because he's agitated. DSK seemed to be very abnormal in his own way.
Oh, well, of course. Dominic Strauss-Kahn, he seems like a psychopath in my view, but go on.
Well, yeah, Diana. Exactly. He's there's something seriously wrong with this guy.
Yep.
I mean, he just sort of can't control himself.
That's right.
And So Hollande then appears as Mr. sort of, you know, any old guy.
Some kind of common sense in all this, is that what you're saying?
He's just sort of, yes, as he said, he's normal. He's nothing, you know, and he's sort of bland and he's inoffensive and he's secretary of the Socialist Party. He's very well educated in the French tradition with all of the schools that lead to top administrative posts. But he doesn't seem to have, I mean, he seems very normal in his political views too. That is to say, very, very much in the middle of the road.
What's interesting here to me then is he comes from the left. Obviously, he would. Is it the radical socialist and radical left party? I'm reading a little bit here as we go, but you can explain this later. But in any regard, what's interesting is that Sarkozy and Merkel has had a pretty tight relationship, as we know. Obviously, they've been propping up the euro. They've been trying to do certain things in order to keep the status quo with the powers that be in the eurozone. Is that anything that potentially might change because of this candidate, or is he going to play ball like everybody else? What do you think?
Well, the general opinion that's going around is that he is going to demand some changes. A lot of people these days are talking about you can't just go on with this austerity program, austerity, mm-hmm. austerity, because
right.
without any growth, that's what's happening to Greece. I mean, you take away any way that people can earn a living, and then you say they have to pay a whole lot of money. They haven't got anything to pay it with.
That's right.
Endlessly impoverishing people and saying, come on, you've got to, balance your budget and pay for this. Pay for it with what? So you just have even very conservative economists will begin to say, well, wait a minute, there's got to be something to grow the economy a bit so that at least they'll get taxed. How can the government pay the bankers, because that's what that debt is about. Why can they pay the bankers when they don't have any more income taxes because there's no more income?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep.
So you need to, and the socialist candidate is being pushed from the left by the left party of Jean-Luc Mélenchon,
mm-hmm.
Calling for increases of the lower wages, a ceiling on the salaries of the top executives in public enterprises, not private. They don't dare touch the private sector. The difference is, he's saying, would be that the top executive, nobody earns more than 20 times the lowest salaried person. Now, to me, that sounds like really enough, but to these guys who are used to making 90 times the lower salary, it looks like real sacrifice,
mm-hmm,
I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it doesn't affect a whole lot of posts. Mélenchon was pointing out, let them go away if they want to go to Switzerland or something. There are other people who are competent who can do the job. Which makes perfect sense to me, but this is very small, and then, tech... So he is going to try, the main thing is to try to get the change of policy of the European Central Bank. And there the Germans just say, no, no, no.
Mm.
And, the Germans, they have their own interests, but they also seem to be neurotic about inflation because of what happened in the 20s.
Well, exactly, but at the same time, they are a money generator within the eurozone. They do have a lot of industry, they're exporting a lot of things, they're producing things still. Hence, we hear, for instance, just the other day, the IMF came out and say, hey, Germany, do more for all the other euro countries. We have the pigs, as they're known. What is it, Portugal, Italy?
Greece
and Spain, right? They have been, yes, exactly. They have been for years kind of, I know where it's a collective eurozone now, but the fact is that they have been, leeching a lot on the other countries.
Well, no, I don't think that's fair to say that at all.
Okay, all right.
For one thing, the different cases are very, very different. I would say, for example, Greece and Spain are totally different cases.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody says that Spain has been, the country has been very well run, the balanced budget, all of that. The problem there was the private sector, which overinvested in housing. there was this bubble, this notion that, Spain has sunshine, you know, but this was private speculation, and they said, you know, so they overbuilt, they built, you know, and zillions of people are going to come and buy gorgeous summer houses in Spain because of the sunshine, and they overbuilt, and then they didn't get their money back, and this is called, so you have a problem in Spain that is totally a problem of the private sector doing what the private sector tends to do, which is to follow the mob. You know, this is a good investment, and then everybody goes that way.
Sure.
And you see, a little bit more regulation can prevent that sort of thing. The thing is that Greece is very different because Greece has never had a very solid government or honest government. But
one thing that has happened there is obviously that Goldman Sachs has been in meddling in Greece economy. They were hiding things from the books, and the fact is that they're not, you know, the primary maybe force behind it, but they're definitely partially responsible for what's happened there. And the fact is, when you bring up this example in Spain, is that other European investors, or is it domestic within Spain, the private sector there? Do you know?
No, it's other investors. That's why the rest are so worried, because you see, it's French banks in Greece. It's French banks that have invested in these. You see, that was the whole thing of having a eurozone with hooray, we can go invest in those economies. And, you know, it takes two to tango, and it's the same everywhere. A bad debt, you blame the debtor, but the person who gave that debt is also responsible for not taking a good look at whether he was really going to get repaid.
Mm-hmm.
But you see, if you think, well, we're going to get repaid because the government of the country will guarantee the loan, but then what happens when the government goes broke? I mean, you know, a huge amount of Greek debt was loans from French and German banks for Greece to buy expensive weapons, including all very, very high weapons. Greece has the largest military budget per capita in Europe, next to France, I think.
Wow, really?
And all of this, why? Why? Mm-hmm. Because they're afraid of Turkey. And they're afraid of Turkey because the West constantly, especially the United States, supports Turkey, and Greeks are never sure about it. I mean, they're both in NATO, and two NATO countries can't be sure that one won't go to a war against the other one. And so Greece has, so this also shows the absurdity of NATO. And the Germans, you see, the arms industry will do anything to sell their weapons, and the banks back their own national arms industry. So Germany can be very virtuous, but they were forcing practically their weapon sales on Greece, which are a huge factor in the Greek debt.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't the ordinary Greek who has been cheating. No, it's,
of course,
this is,
yep,
at the highest level.
Yep. Absolutely, it's a mess. There's a lot of people who are speculating that the euro will collapse, and the collapse is imminent. I personally don't believe so. I believe that this speculation, this gambling with the debt, with people's money and everything else, has been actually allowed to a certain extent. They've been doing it in the upper, you know, circles, in the elites, so that later on the whole financial industry, the whole financial system, both within Europe but in other countries as well, will be even more tougher regulated. I mean, have you heard about the...
Well, maybe it should be regulated, because in fact, what had been happening for decades, Henrik, is that all of the pressure from the ideologues, free market ideologues, which means also the financial industries who are paying for them and so on, has been deregulate. What does that mean? Deregulate so we can play our games and cheat better. And that's what they've done, and then it brings the whole thing down, as it did with this fancy, hugely fancy kind of debts that they work out. You know, I mean, I don't understand all of this.
Yeah,
no. I'm a simple person. I balance my books. I don't borrow more than I can pay. I borrow as little as possible. I'm not into this high finance mentality.
Mm.
But the thing is that they have deregulated precisely so they could work out all these crazy schemes, and it's all different kinds of pyramid schemes that you can make money out of money.
Yeah.
And without really manufacturing or doing anything useful, and the money just keeps circulating around and getting bigger and bigger and bigger until something goes wrong and a bubble bursts. And they were complicit in this thing with Greece. You see, I gather that anybody who was paying any attention knew that the books were being fiddled in Greece. But as long as they could make money off of that and sell things like weapons and whatnot, well, they'd go ahead. And the ordinary Greek people have nothing to do with this. So you see, it's really very unpleasant that then there comes a sort of racism against the lazy Greeks. I mean, most people in the North, they only know Greece from going on vacation, where they see other people who are on vacation, and gosh, it looks like all the Greeks are so lazy. You don't see people working, except, you know, you don't have a real view of what that country is like for the people who are living there.
They have a huge tourist industry, obviously, and we know that that's partially what many of the austerity measures have been. Well, what are they going to do? Rent out the Parthenon to McDonald's? I mean, it's
well,
horrendous.
They might even sell it, and then, you know, you sell the family jewels, and then you're broke forever.
Yeah, yeah.
This is, well, as for the euro, what happens to the euro, I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's now pretty much a majority opinion that Greece is going to leave the eurozone. But, you know, that has been obvious for a couple of years. But they've kept it in. They've kept Greece in long enough to bail out the banks to a pretty much extent. And they've ruined the ordinary economy to such an extent that now they can let it go.
Well, also, Dana, they can't leave now. They're now dependent. There's no now so entrenched into the system of debt as well, tied to the euro, that they cannot leave. I mean, there's been a party now. Now everybody has a hangover. The rats have left the ships. And what I fear is that we're going to be left with is an environment completely, I mean, stranglehold regulation and control for the little guy, the small business owner, those who generate money, while the big monopoly companies and the upper elite will go on as usual. And that's what I fear in this. That I understand the idea of regulation to the extent of like the Glass-Steagall Act, this kind of regulation, right?
Well, that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about regulation of the financial markets.
Yep.
Everything here, I mean, in France, you know, there's very little income tax in France, but there's huge sales taxes. And, of course, those hit the little guy the same.
Yep.
You know, gasoline tax, things like that.
Yep.
That doesn't bother your millionaire a bit, but it's very hard on the little farmer or the little guy who's got a little business and he has to drive to it and
yeah,
so on.
Yeah, exactly, yes.
And now, the socialists have sort of said they want to limit it because that's a difference. But there's already huge sales taxes here. That's a very inegalitarian type of tax.
Okay, by the way, just for reference, can you give me a percentage? What is usually the? I mean, I know they will be different for gas and for other items and services and stuff. But can you give me a general idea how much we're talking about?
Well, for gasoline, it's huge. You know, especially it's 60% or more.
Yeah, same here as in Sweden. Then 60% is tax.
I think it's 60%. Of other things as well, the restaurant maybe 7% or it varies.
It varies. Okay. Well, we have a set just for reference for people out there listening to and for your reference. We have basically a set sales tax on 25% on everything, from service to goods and everything else. And this is the VAT, the value added tax, you know, within Europe.
Yes,
but then they might add an extra. The euro might add an extra tax on top of what already is within the nation. This is beyond belief. This is going to ruin everybody if they do this. You know,
I have an impression which is shared by ordinary folk like me, that the euro has brought a huge inflation that nobody admits. Yesterday I happened to be at the Coupole in Montparnasse and I was thirsty, so I stopped for a lemonade. And the lemonade cost me €6.50.
You're kidding.
I stopped and thought about it, and that's more than 50 French francs.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine 10 years ago of paying anything close to 50 francs for a squeezed lemon.
What is that? Let me just pull that up in U.S. dollars. What is the exchange rate right now? That's just interesting.
I don't know. It fluctuates, but it's the euro is worth more than the dollar. 1.30, I think.
How much did you pay for it there again, you said?
$6.50.
That is, just for our listeners in the United States, that's
$8.5
U.S. dollars, approximately. Wow, that's amazing. Uh-huh. Yeah,
and you see, I'm comparing it to the French franc. The French franc, that's hard when you haven't lived with it. But you know, having lived with it, it's just extraordinary. I mean, you wouldn't even. It's really out of sight.
Yeah.
You think compare it to what you could get for 50 French francs before the euro.
That's right.
A couple of meals.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. We'll see where this ends and goes. But again, I don't think that they ever will. I mean, these are people who print the money. It's not based on anything true or real valuable behind the scenes. There's no gold backing. So they can just continue. That's what I see anyway. They can just continue to print the money and be definitely in debt. I mean, if they would like to, I guess they could just write it off and begin anew and continue the system as it is. But still, what it means would continually be a drain on people. The people would be poor and couldn't be able to make a move or do anything within the system. I don't know. We'll just have to see.
Well, I don't. You see, the thing. One of the things I mentioned in the article is that. People here are complaining a lot, but France is a rich country, and people aren't hurting enough to really start revolting in any way. You know, it's not like Greece, but of course, or Spain.
But yet this is the revolutionary French that are out on the street once a year, right?
Well, some of them are, but some of them aren't. You see, I mean, it's not everybody. And of course, they still have got a lot of, even Sarkozy hasn't got rid of all of the social nets, you know.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And so I think probably Hollande can try to stall for time, but there is really a problem that this whole policy of going into austerity. If it's good for the Germans, but it's not good for anybody else in the eurozone.
Now, that's an important point. Let me just wing this by again then. Stall for time versus a crash. I've always argued, would it be better? I mean, in the short term, it would be worse with a crash because that would make people really hurt. But it would also be an opportunity at that point to actually reconstruct the system, maybe even potentially for nations for themselves to go their own way, but still, of course, cooperating with other nations. But if we have a stall for time, it's like you're pouring salt in the wounds. You're dragging out the torture, the pain of this. What do you think?
Well, you know, this it's so one is, as you say, so involved in this now. It's hard to get out, but I think a certain getting out is necessary. I think a lot of people in Sweden. My impression is that years ago, I mean, talking to Swedish people, there was a prevailing attitude at least among the Swedish people I was talking to, mm-hmm. that what you needed was more of a Europe one issue at a time, you know, cooperate together on this, cooperate together. The trouble with the European Union is that it has shoved everybody together on supposedly everything.
Mm-hmm. Yep, yep.
Without real consent. The commission is constantly giving these directives, everybody has to do this, everybody has to do that. In some ways, it's more unifying than in the United States, which is crazy.
Yeah.
This whole thing of forcing everybody into the same pattern is, well, the euro is just the most extreme case of it.
Yeah.
That's not the way to do things. You know, you should certainly you should have cooperation, but it ought to be. Let's look about fishing, and then look about agriculture. You know, and this one and that one. But take it sort of with more democracy, more consultation of populations. Populations don't even realize to what extent that their own parliaments can't make the rules anymore because they just have to carry out what's been decided in Brussels.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I mean, it's they've had trade agreements in the early days, energy agreements. There have been a lot of focus on the agricultural control in the beginning of the Eurozone. Mm-hmm. But now they obviously have proceeded without the consent of most people. And as we know, the Council of Europe that holds that is unelected has the main power. They've even now gotten a precedent in there that nobody in the entire, among the 500 million or so people in Europe, haven't got a say in this. I mean, what did they expect? That people should just be, oh, great, let's go. We haven't decided anything or elected anybody here that are, you know, pulling the strings. It's unbelievable.
Well, it really has turned into a machine to completely destroy democracy. There's so little that is left to member states to decide, and yet we're talking about making wars because other countries aren't democratic enough. We've got to use weapons to get rid of their dictators and make sure they're democratic, although that's not really what happens
right.
when we get rid of their dictators.
Of course.
You get chaos instead.
Just what they want, so they can take over the resources or whatever the real plan is there. But what do you think, if we just for a moment here tied back to the election, I want to ask you one more thing there before we, you know, begin a little bit to round things up. There has been, or rather was there a point in the election, I don't know how closely you followed it, between Francois Hollande and Nicolas Sarkozy, where they were like, it was just only them two left, and they were having a debate and so over some critical issue, and hence Sarkozy failed? Or what happened there? Was there any drama involved? Or
I don't think there was any drama. Sarkozy decided to try to get the National Front votes. And so his campaign was very much a far-right campaign. And maybe, I mean, he's a clever politician, so I suppose he knew what he was doing, trying to get those votes, and he got a lot of them, no doubt. But he didn't get all of them, and he didn't get Marine Le Pen's vote because, you see, she's a rival on the right. She wants to knock out the right so she can take over.
Mm, yep.
And so she announced she wasn't going to vote for him. And so she couldn't order the people who voted for her to vote one way or another, and I think probably most of them did vote for Sarkozy, but a lot of them did not, and so he didn't get all of her votes. And in the debate, it was much about personalities, and the thing is that Sarkozy is so aggressive that a lot of people just can't stand his personality, frankly. a lot of people are just allergic to him. They just really don't like him. I mean, it's they don't like his policies either, but they particularly don't like his personality. And I think that Hollande wasn't marvelous, but he kept his calm and didn't get provoked by this very aggressive Sarkozy. And it didn't, again, that didn't make any difference either. Sarkozy did rather better than one could expect from the polls. But still, it was really to be expected that he would go. There's a lot of antagonism to him, toward him, and a lot of things.
I wanted to say as well, yet he's a known face and name at this stage, and I'm wondering, I don't think we've seen the end of it. I don't think he's going to come back in one form or another, perhaps even as a prominent position somewhere within the European Union. What do you think, Diana?
I really don't know. I mean, he was toying with the idea of saying he was resigning from politics, but was discouraged from going that far by people around him who say, oh, no, he'll make a comeback.
Yeah.
I don't know. The fact is that the whole political personnel in France is not inspiring. That's true in most of the world now. I mean, really, in most of the West, in any case. I don't know so much about all of the world, but certainly in the West, this is not a time of great political leaders.
Yeah, I know.
It's just nobody that really seems to have... you have poll watchers. That's all. You have people who are trying to be popular, who are looking to public opinion polls and what is this and what can you say. But there's nobody with that really seems to. The most interesting person in this election was Jean-Luc Mélenchon, the left party leader. But, he sort of went up and then went down a little bit, because first it was delightful to see somebody really, eloquent and passionate on the left. We haven't seen anybody like that. And he's a very talented speaker. But actually, examining his program, he's not that much to the left. To me, a very important thing is the war and peace issue, and he is not very, very clear on that.
All right. Yeah, interesting. Well, I think we haven't seen the end of Sarkozy anyway. I mean, people have even referred to him as Little Napoleon, so I think at the moment he's exiled at Elba, but he'll come back with full force.
Well, you may think so. I really am not going to predict anything. I avoid predictions. Always surprised.
No worries about that. Okay, well, I think we should round things up for this time. Thank you for coming on again, Diana. It's been great talking with you once again. Why don't you mention some of your titles that you have out there? By the way, I just discovered the other day as well that your book has been banned in Sweden.
Banned?
Yeah. It was one of the first. Let me pull this up so I can read this for you. Under Diana Johnston, this is on Wikipedia. Johnston was the subject of some controversy after 2003. Blah blah blah. This was your book, Fool's Crusade: Yugoslavia, NATO, and the Western Delusion. The book was rejected from publishing in Sweden.
Oh yes, but it was published. Listen, you can find that there's an excellent account of that. On the internet, written by Al Burke, in English, he wrote the whole thing up, an account of that event. It was finally published by somebody after that, but it wasn't banned in Sweden. That's not does Wikipedia say it's banned?
Not banned. It was the wrong word for me. There was a rejected publishing, and therefore I thought it was not just available in Sweden. That was my conclusion.
Well, it is actually. Yeah.
Okay.
It is, but I can't give you the reference offhand.
Okay.
But it's a very interesting event about that story. And can I give you the reference? It's called All Quieted on the Word Front.
Yep.
And you can find it at www.nnn.se/n-model/foreign/ordfront period, PDF.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Look, maybe you can send me that URL or something after the recording.
Yes,
and I can link that up.
I can send you that.
Yeah.
And because Al Burke wrote it, and he's a good writer, among other things. It's a very interesting account of the whole thing. I mean, he knows more about it than I do because I don't know Sweden.
I
couldn't follow it all.
Yeah, I have an article right here, Ord Front, as you mentioned, which is like word front, you know, it's the Battle
right.
of the Pens. Yeah. So I have a link to that there. And even within this article, there is a link to the URL that you just mentioned. And that's actually down at the moment. It's not available.
It is.
No.
Uh-huh.
Okay,
well, I'm going to write to Al and ask him about that.
Maybe the PDF is still there. I was looking at the HTML page for that. I think the PDF is there. In any regard, we will definitely link that up. But take this opportunity as well, Diana, to mention if there's any titles out there that you want to give out as well to people. Your books is available on Amazon and stuff, but you don't have a personal website yet. Is that correct?
No, I don't. So just do that. That's enough. I mean, other things are collective, and I don't want to... Just work on this one. Okay.
All right. Okay, thank you so much for coming on today, Diana. Stay with me a little bit here on the line. I want to ask you something off the air as well. But thank you again for coming on. Great having you with us.
Okay, thank you.
That's our program for today, ladies and gentlemen. Next on Red Ice Radio, we have Holland van den Nieuwenhof and James Lane on their film A Noble Lie, the Oklahoma City bombing. Then we have Tom Horn on Petrus Romanus, the prophecy of the final pope. Louise Turry on astropsychology and the power of the dragon. Then Dean Clifford, John B. Wells, Ian Crane, Neil Kramer, Richard Merrick, Nora Gedgaudas, Britt D. and Tom Secker, Richard Grove, Winter Lake, Alex Newman, Peter Halderson, Eric Karlström, and Jordan Maxwell will be coming on the program. Don't forget to check out our member section for much more. Get a membership if you like what we do and want to hear more. In the meantime, take good care, and we'll see you later. Bye-bye.